This meeting is now being recorded.
So again, welcome to the Revenue Distribution Training WebEx. We know your time is valuable, and we appreciate that you chose to spend the next few hours with us. We have lots of exciting information for you today, so let's get started. As I said before, welcome, and thank you for being here with us. In just a moment, I will introduce the faculty that will be presenting today. Some of them you have heard from before, and some of the voices will be new. The topics that we intend to cover today include updates or new legislation, as well as updates to the uniform bail and penalty schedule, along with other collection activities.
Okay, thank you. You
too. So just, we're going to go through some housekeeping stuff, but if here in the beginning, if you guys could please mute your phones, that would be extremely helpful. So also on the training agenda, we're going to hear from the Franchise Tax Board and the State Comptroller's Office. We have some information on the live on our upcoming live training, so save the date. And if you need a training certificate at the end, we will tell you how. So with no further ado, let's introduce the Judicial Council staff. From Office of Governmental Affairs, we have Mark Neuberger. And we have the esteemed Andy Liebenbaum. From the Criminal Justice Services, we have Jamie Schuckner. And from the Funds and Revenue Unit, myself, Donna Newman, Maria Lira, and Manny Nandapat. From the Franchise Tax Board, we will have Jennifer Jacobson, along with Alex Escobar. And from the State Controller's Office, we will hear from Alexandria Green, but we also have Sandeep Singh and Don Lowry for your reference. And from the Audit Division, you'll be hearing from Chris Ryan. I'd like to hand it over to Mark Neuberger. He is going to handle some of the housekeeping information.
Thanks, Donna, and good afternoon to you all. I just want to go over some general information that's applicable to the presentation, and we'll make it go smoothly for all of us. First, once again, to echo Donna, please mute your phone. That way you won't have distracting other noises, and you can focus on listening to presenters. Also, please do not place your phone on hold. If you place your phone on hold, all of us will begin hearing your organization's hold music, which in certain cases, your organization does come on and know who they are, so you may know who you are. Also, please use the WebEx user for questions. Send all your chat questions to me, Mark Neuberger. Just as a heads up, if your chat questions are complex, I may ask you for your email address so we can research the parameters of your questions and get back to you at a later time. If you don't want to use chat, you can also email your questions to the Comptroller's Office or the Judicial Council emails listed on this slide. Don't worry, we'll show these emails again at later points of the presentation. Also, I want to stress that we will have some pauses in between sections as we transition to a new speaker. So real quick, for those of you who are not familiar with WebEx or you're new to WebEx, I just wanted to go over how to use the chat feature. You should notice on the right-hand side of your screen sort of a chat panel. In this slide, it's outlined with a red box. This is the chat panel. This will be able to show participants and the host. Here's a little more detailed look that you should be seeing on your screen or something similar. It displays the host and participants and kind of lets you know who's talking or presenting at the time. I've highlighted the host, in this case listed as Rose Butler, with a red arrow. You'll also see my name just above it, and that's who you should be sending chat questions to. So the text bottom is at the bottom of the chat box. I've highlighted it with the red box in this slide. I just want to stress that you make sure you're sending who your chat to. You can do that by selecting in that red box the two. Just a real reminder, when you're sending a chat to everyone, that means it's going to go to every single person logged on to WebEx, where if you send it to a specific person, like me, that chat question will just go to me, and I'll make sure I route it to the presenter to see if they can answer it, and if not, then I'll get back to you or follow up to research your question.
Yeah.
Okay, and just once again, just like Snoopy there on the in the picture, please make sure you place your phone on mute. Don't place this on hold. We had a lot of difficulty yesterday with mute versus hold, so I really want to stress that today. Place your phone on mute. Okay, a couple more housekeeping things to go over. Your feedback is important to us, and it does help us improve these trainings and sort of modify and change the focus of the topic so that they're still relevant to you. To that end, we'll send out an evaluation questionnaire after this WebEx. Please complete the questionnaire and get your feedback to us. You should be, this should be kind of sent to you through a SurveyMonkey type questionnaire, and it's due, it'll be due by December 21st. We will be posting the PowerPoint and audio of this presentation on our website by around December 14th. Also, if you need a training completion certificate to show that you went to the attended this training course, it is available upon request. Please email the revenue distribution email inbox that you see on the email you see on your screen for the for your request. Ken, I wanted to go over the training goals of this presentation. First, I'll provide an update on recent legislation that impacts revenue distributions. Then, Judicial Council staff will identify changes to the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule that will be effective this coming January. You'll get an update on the status of the Futures Traffic Working Group. We'll also present information on the legislative collections and related reports that are due and kind of where we are with the making trying to make modifications of those reports. The Franchise Tax Board will provide a review of its two programs. And the State Comptroller's Office will go over any changes to its revenue distribution guidelines and also provide an overview of audit findings that they have that are relevant to the trial court. Finally, at the end, we will provide the dates for the spring 2019 collection training that we do in person in Southern and Northern California. So just as the final stop, final part of the housekeeping, I wanted to review the basic structure of the state revenue collection process. As you can tell from this chart, it's a very complicated process with many entities performing different roles. Note the courts and the counties responsible for collection of criminal and civic traffic penalties, while cities and universities are responsible for parking violations. And fun fact, I got a parking violation yesterday, and right printed on it was the amount split that is owed to the city and the amount that's owed to the state. But I'll rely on the State Comptroller's Office to ensure the city of Sacramento does that split correctly and hopefully timely. And so, moving on, I just want to stress right now we're moving into the presentation itself, where I will be giving you an update on recent legislative changes that were enacted and became effective. This is kind of a high-level overview of the 2017-18 legislative session outcomes. So first, the Office of Governmental Affairs does publish an annual summary of legislation that was passed this year. We usually make this report available at the end of November of every year, and in true fashion, at the end of November, we released this year's 2018 summary of court-related legislation. It is available on the Office of Government Affairs Council website, and we do sort the legislation, the report, into different general categories that are so you can kind of focus in on certain areas that may be of interest to you. Also, at the very end, we provide an appendix of new or expanded crimes or changed crimes that some also will have an impact on the fines and fees collection, your fines and fees revenue collection. So finally, I wanted just to go over a couple bills that do impact your revenue collection process. I want to stress, typically bills have a January 1st effective date. In this case, bills passed 2018 will be effective January 1st, 2019, except for that first bill. SB 847 is a budget trailer bill, and because of that, it went into effect immediately after it was passed, in this case, June 27th, 2018. This particular bill created a pilot program for online adjudication of traffic violations, and it allowed for 8 courts to be participants in the pilot. Those 8 courts are San Francisco, Santa Clara, Tulare, Shasta, Ventura, Monterey, El Dorado, and Fresno. So if you're an employee of any of those courts and you weren't aware of this online traffic pilot program, I suggest that you reach out to your court administration to find out more information and determine how it may impact your revenue collection process. Moving on, AB 2201 eliminates certain fees for petitioners seeking name change if they are a victim of specific crimes. Also, AB 3246 makes some clarifications regarding base fines for failure to show proof of insurance. It essentially clarifies that if you fail to show insurance at the initial traffic stop, that base fine still applies to you, even if you're able to show the correction later on when the individual appears in court. So essentially, the original base fine for failure to show proof of insurance still holds. And finally, AB 1755 clarifies that vehicle code traffic accident reporting requirements apply to bicyclists on bike trails. So you may start seeing more of these particular incidents as more people get on bikes and get in crashes, where they may be cited for failure to report, and of course the penalties that go along for failure to report apply in these cases. So moving on, I'm just going to review if we have any questions from chat and from the WebEx chat. I am not seeing any, so without further ado, Jamie Schechter from the Council's Criminal Justice Service will provide an update on uniform bail and penalty schedules that are going to become effective this coming year.
Hi. I'm Jamie Schechter, and this is the uniform bail and penalty schedule. A little bit about me. I am staff to the Traffic Advisory Committee, and the uniform bail and penalty schedules are one of the primary responsibilities of the Traffic Advisory Committee. I am also staff to the Traffic Working Group and the Ability to Pay Work Group. We will talk a little bit more later about the Futures Traffic Working Group. So on to the uniform bail and penalty schedules. I know that we have different levels of experience in this webinar, and so for some attendees, this may be a little basic, but I want to try to provide a good overview. So here is a roadmap of what we will cover today. Bail in this context, the uniform bail and penalty schedules, the approval by the Judicial Council, traffic infraction schedule, the concept of total bail, the countywide bail schedules, using the uniform bail and penalty schedules as a guide, and the actual penalties, fees, as add-ons, and changes to the 2019 edition, as well as additional resources. What is bail? It's helpful to think about the uniform bail and penalty schedules in terms of what it is not. So when I describe the uniform bail and penalty schedules to people, one of the first things I find myself saying is, oh, well, it's not real bail. Because when someone hears the word bail, they usually think of cash bail or so-called regular bail. For instance, the $25,000 amount used to secure a defendant's appearance after arraignment. And as most of you probably know, there has been a recent legislative change to the cash bail system through SB 10. And so we're going to take a quick detour for a couple of slides, talk about SB 10, and then we will come back and talk about the uniform bail and penalty schedule. SB 10 made substantial changes to the cash bail system, and I'm just going to briefly discuss those. There are obviously entire trainings just on SB 10, so I'm going to give a very high-level overview. SB 10 reforms the procedure for release and detention of people arrested for misdemeanors and felonies. The new mechanism for release depends on the risk assessment and non-monetary conditions as opposed to cash bail. SB 10 provides for a presumption for release on the least restrictive non-monetary conditions, and it provides for preventative detention for more high-risk defendants. So now that we've taken a quick detour and talked about regular bail and recent changes to that, let's talk about traffic bail. Traffic bail is the amount that a defendant must forfeit to cancel the need for future court proceedings. When a defendant forfeits bail for a traffic infraction, they are not pleading guilty. Instead, they are forfeiting bail, understanding that that bail forfeiture will be treated as a conviction. So how did SB 10 impact traffic bail? In short, it really doesn't, except now the term traffic bail is even more confusing. So here is the actual uniform bail and penalty schedules for 2019. The Judicial Council is required by statute to have a uniform penalty schedule for all non-parking traffic infractions. And here's the front page of the 2019 edition. Sometimes just called the bail schedule, although we are trying to emphasize the penalty schedule aspect of this document to avoid the more confusing bail terminology. The 2019 version was just adopted at the November 30th Judicial Council meeting, and as of this morning, the 2019 version was actually posted on the Public California Courts website and the Judicial Resources Network. The Judicial Council is mandated to have a penalty schedule for traffic infractions, and courts are mandated to use these amounts. But there are actually seven other penalty schedules. And other than vehicle code infractions, the seven, traffic misdemeanors, boating, forestry, fish and game, public utilities, parks and recreation, and business licensing, penalty amounts are actually advisory for the court. These different schedules were added over the years for standardization and based on the requests of different agencies for the most part. Something worth noting is that not all crimes are listed in the uniform bail and penalty schedules. For instance, there's no penal code schedule at all. And while public utilities has a schedule, not all public utility codes violations are in there. So the seven other penalty schedules, other than the traffic vehicle code infractions, are not comprehensive. And for traffic infractions, vehicle code infractions, they should all be in the uniform bail and penalty schedules, and they may not be. And if you see something, you can always just email me if you get a citation for a vehicle code infraction and it doesn't appear to be in there. All counties must follow the Judicial Council's traffic penalty schedule, except for these 30. So as you can see, 58 counties, more counties can exceed the bail schedule than must follow it. Vehicle code offenses are currently infractions by default. So unless a crime is designated as a misdemeanor or a felony or parking or toll violation, it's an infraction. The statute requires the Judicial Council adopt a traffic penalty schedule, and that also requires the penalty schedule have four or fewer categories based on severity. These are the four categories and the base fines for each category. Category 1 is mostly equipment and bicyclist violations. Category 2 is mostly moving violations. Category 3 is more severe infractions. And Category 4 is miscellaneous, and the base fine depends. For example, for Vehicle Code Section 2815, that is a Category 4 offense. It has a $50 base fine, because Vehicle Code Section 4201.1 provides for base fine of $50 for a first conviction for this offense. So Vehicle Code Section 2815 would be a miscellaneous Category 4 on the bail schedule. The bail schedule has a total bail concept, meaning there's a base fine and various penalties and mandatory fees. And here's a sample of how that would break down for the various categories. Again, since Category 4 is miscellaneous, obviously the penalties will depend on what the base fine is for a particular Category 4 offense. And here are the suggested total bail amounts for vehicle code misdemeanors, public utilities, and the other schedules. This is for crimes where penalty is not listed in the statute. So if a particular vehicle code misdemeanor, for instance, has a base fine in statute or provides for a range, that amount will not be a $75 base fine in the uniform bail and penalty schedule. Again, worth noting, not all crimes are listed in these other schedules. When you look at a vehicle code infraction violation in the bail schedule, here's what it looks like, but normally the vehicle code section shows. We had to cut that off to make the slide readable. But for example, vehicle code section 4453.6 is the failure to furnish name and address to an officer. It's a Category 2 with a $35 base fine. Justice Code Section 4454 is failure to maintain registration cards vehicle, and that's a $25 base fine. And Justice Code Section 4454 has two entries because it is a correctable violation. Those are the $25 base fine. The one with only the base fine is the amount that would apply if the person actually corrects the violation, whereas the base fine with all the assessments is the amount that would apply if the person does not correct it. We're going to get into the changes for 2019 later, but some of the changes were adding or deleting correctable lines based either on legislation or based on a justice partner noticing something in the bail schedule that should be there or something that should not be there. So again, if throughout the year you see things that you believe should be changed, please let me know. Someone actually just emailed me, and I have my first recommendation for the 2020 Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule. So we have a list going, so please feel free to contact me throughout the year. And you can see here that the total bail amount for various violations is also listed. Here is a breakdown of the add-ons to the base fine and the statutory authority for those. And these add-ons make up the total bail amount. So here are the changes for 2019. I'm going to go through all these pretty quickly in the interest of your time. And feel free to contact me afterwards if you have questions about these changes. But changes were made to the schedules based on new legislation, requests from outside agencies, primarily the Department of Fish and Wildlife, justice partners, including the DMV, or staff or courts finding errors or omissions in the existing uniform bail and penalty schedules. So this first slide shows changes made based on new legislation to the traffic infraction schedule. Of note here, Vehicle Code Section 21761 does not go into effect until January 1st, 2020, but we recommended adding it to the 2019 schedule so that it does not get lost. I will try to point out a few new laws along the way, and if you're interested in specific changes, the Judicial Council report has that information. Next slide, please. Here are more infraction changes. Interesting here that 27150 subdivision A and 27151 subdivision A have changes to their previous correctability, where the correctability line was removed from the bail schedules for those two offenses. Here are some seatbelt changes for drivers and passengers on buses. Section 35551 was changed to increase the allowable weight for electric vehicles because electric vehicles have heavier batteries. So the Traffic Advisory Committee changed the footnote for computing allowable gross weight to reflect that change. Here are some changes to the misdemeanor traffic schedules based on new law. These were changes to the DUI section. And here are some more changes to the DUI sections, as well as a footnote for the business licensing schedule, and that footnote was also based on new legislation. There were a lot of changes to the fish and game schedule based on requests from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And because the penalty schedules, other than the vehicle code fractions, were mostly added over the years based on requests from outside agencies, the Department of Fish and Wildlife had significant input on this schedule. This year there were several requests, not necessarily based on new legislation, but on statutes and regulations that they thought should be added or expanded or deleted. And again, this schedule is advisory. There's some more fish and game violations. Here's some more. And some more. We did have some discussion about the hunting over bait to make sure that we understood that violation. So these were changes to the uniform bail and penalty schedules based on requests from justice partners recommending changes to the existing schedules. So again, if you notice something that should be changed, just bring it to my attention. And here were a couple of statutes that were added and also relettered. And these statutes were mostly added. They were not previously in the schedules, but the Traffic Advisory Committee determined that they should be. These statutes were mostly changed in the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedules to reflect the naming changes due to marijuana versus cannabis and also some DMV point issues. And these were more changes based on input of violations that should be in the schedule that were not currently in there, and also ones that should be deleted. Here, the Traffic Advisory Committee removed the correctable lines for 38375 and added a correctable line to 34507 and 34507.5, and that was based on a request from a court. And finally, this was simply a technical change. The last year's schedule did not actually have a subdivision A, and it just had the numbers next to it. So we added that this year. So every year, courts need to update their case management system. And as I said, the schedules are currently available on the Judicial Resources Network, also on the public website in PDF form as of today. Here is my information. So please feel free to contact me if you have any questions about the bail schedules, or again, if you notice any errors or omissions. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. Any questions, comments? Nothing coming in through chat. So this is Andy Liebenbaum, and I also am at Judicial Council. I work in our Office of Governmental Affairs. If you don't have us on mute, please just hit the mute button. Go ahead and hit the mute button. You'll still be able to hear us, but we won't be able to hear you, and that might be a good thing. So let's talk about the Futures Traffic Working Group. The Futures Traffic Working Group was convened by the Chief Justice after a report that the Chief Justice received in 2017, in which there was a recommendation to improve access to justice, increase criminal court efficiency and effectiveness, and address the potentially disproportionate negative consequences of minor criminal violations. So with that report, the Chief formed the Futures Traffic Working Group to develop a proposal to implement and evaluate a civil model for adjudication of minor vehicle infractions. And we've highlighted civil model and minor vehicle infractions because we're going to dive a little deeply into what those two things mean. So a civil model is informed by recognizing that currently infractions are considered crimes. Now, they certainly are low-level crimes, but as you may know or you have heard, if somebody fails to pay or fails to appear on an infraction, and that infraction compounds with additional fines, fees, penalties, and assessments, it is conceivable that a failure to appear or a failure to pay could become a misdemeanor. And so somebody who got a simple driving infraction now no longer just has the infraction on their record, but they have a misdemeanor on their record. The idea
is to move infractions from the criminal universe into the civil universe. And essentially what that means is that if you avoid coming to court on your civil infraction, you will not get stiffer penalties. There won't be compounded penalties. There won't be the chance that you could now be suffering from a misdemeanor, not just an infraction. Another significant change would be that there would no longer be civil assessments assessed for failures to appear and failures to pay. And really the end game would be if a violator simply ignored the court, ignored the order, a judgment would be entered. It's conceivable that would be a default judgment because they didn't pay attention. If somebody goes to court willingly, it would just be a judgment entered against them. There wouldn't be a crime, and it wouldn't have any of those compounding effects. The definition of what makes a vehicle infraction minor was a matter of some discussion with the Futures Traffic Working Group. And the decision that was made and that will be recommended is that all vehicle code violations will be included, not just driving violations. So, for example, bicycle violations, scooter violations, jaywalking violations. The only violations that will be included, however, will be infractions, not misdemeanors. So when Jamie was talking a moment ago about the different schedules inside the uniform bail and penalty schedule, one of the other schedules is the misdemeanor schedule. That would not count. Only infraction vehicle code violations will be considered minor vehicle infractions. So what's next for the Futures Traffic Working Group? Currently, we are drafting proposed legislation, and when I say we, I'm taking credit for something I have very little to do with. Jamie is doing all the heavy lifting, but essentially on behalf of the Futures Traffic Working Group, staff is coming up with the actual statutory language changes. The Futures Traffic Working Group will be reviewing all of that proposed language, at which point it will be made publicly available. We will publish an invitation to comment. That'll be your cue and the cue of the public to read through the recommendations and provide any comments or feedback or questions or requests for clarification. At the end of the invitation to comment period, staff will respond to any comments that have come in, at which point the Judicial Council likely will approve all of the proposed changes to be sponsored as legislation. That could happen a year from right now. The timeline is as follows. The invitation to comment will be the spring and summer of 2019. An invitation to comment specifically means that we will send out a link. All of you will receive it. You'll be able to go online by following that link and read all of the proposed changes that we are contemplating. Once the invitation to comment period is over, the Judicial Council, sometime next fall, will be reviewing and ideally approving all of those recommended changes. And then a year from about right now, or early 2020, my staff and I will be trying to introduce the changes into legislation. With regards to how this impacts you, collections are still going to be required. And it's also likely that distributions are not going to be seriously impacted, except that there is very much there's a very strong likelihood that less money will be collected and therefore distributed because civil assessments will be eliminated and there won't be other criminal fines, fees, and penalties. So to the extent that your job includes collections and distributions, those functions are going to remain relatively unchanged. But as you're going to hear in a moment with the trend in collections being a reduction in revenue, we anticipate that if the conviction, the traffic violations become civil instead of criminal, there will be a reduction in the revenue that is collected. you can follow the activities of the Futures Traffic Working Group by following the link that you see on your screen. Jamie knows many things about the Futures Traffic Working Group. So once again, here's her contact email. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. I'm going to check the WebEx and see. There don't appear to be any questions that have been submitted, so I am going to turn over the presentation to Maria, who's going to talk to you about collections.
Thank you, Andy. Hello, everyone. Thank you all for joining us. Today, I would just like to share with you a few collection-related information updates. First, I'll provide a summary of the collection reports that were submitted to the legislature for the 2017-18 reporting period. Andy will then speak to the importance of reducing the $10.3 billion in outstanding delinquent debt to a more realistic amount through the discharge process. Last but not least, we'll get an update on the status of the statewide master agreements for Manny. This reporting period was unlike any other. Not only were you required to gather additional collections data, but you had to submit the collections reporting template twice. For those of you involved in the collections reporting process who worked on the July and the September CRT, thank you very much. We were able to meet both deadlines for submitting the reports to the legislature, both in October and just recently for the December one. For the December report, it was just submitted to the legislature earlier this week, and it's now posted on our website. So, again, thank you all that participated in the reporting process. We realized that the process was time-consuming, and we could definitely appreciate everyone's frustration from those of you that stressed it to us. That said, please know that our Office of Government Affairs is diligently working on getting the reports combined so that the CRT is submitted only once in September. We'll keep you informed of any changes to the reporting timeline. So on to the first reporting requirement. For those of you that are familiar with the CRT and with the new reporting requirements, you probably have already memorized these eight items on the slide. These became effective June 27, 2017, when Section 68514 was added to the government code requiring that each court and county collections program report information on these items, in addition to what was already being submitted to us annually in September pursuant to Penal Code 1463.010. So to comply with this requirement, we revamped the CRT. We revised it to capture the new data, and it was reformatted to separate the data by period, by current and then all prior periods as required by Subdivision B of the Government Code. The statute required that the Judicial Council submit the information that you submitted to us to the Department of Finance and the Joint Legislative Budget Committee by October 1st. So to meet that deadline, we asked the program to submit the report to us by July 16th. As permitted by Subdivision C of the Government Code, the requested collections information was reported to us to the extent possible, and then programs followed up with any missing or revised data on the September CRT. So again, it was a lot of added work for all the programs. The news is that all 58 programs did submit the CRT in July. However, as we expected, not all programs were able to fully comply with the reporting requirements, and that was due to a few reasons. Some of the most common challenges that were reported was that the requested information was not available, primarily due to the case management and accounting system limitations, but also because the programs were not previously required to report this information, let alone at the level of detail that was being requested. Lastly, the programs didn't have enough time to report the 10 days from the end of year closing to the July 16th due date. It was just simply not enough time. And again, we understand that, but appreciate your responsiveness to the reporting requirements. The report did have some data gaps, but we are confident, as are the programs or you that are on the line, that the reporting will improve as you move forward with your reprogramming of the case management system and also collaborating with your collection entities. We are confident that the level of data that you submit will be more complete and more accurate. Again, if you would like to read more on the detail that was submitted to the legislature, the report is posted on our website at the URL that's on the slide. So a little bit about the data. The value in yellow here is the difference between the information that was submitted to us in July versus in the September CRT. There was significant information missing in the July report, as you can see here. Again, for more information, you could more detail on these numbers and explanations as to the level of detail can be obtained in the report that is now available. Both reports are now available on our website. So as I indicated, the second report that is submitted to us in September is pursuant to Penal Code 1453.010. And based on the information that the program submitted to us, there was a total of $583.5 million that was collected from 2.1 million delinquent accounts, with total operating costs of $166 million. The programs were able to identify uncollectible debt and discharge $166 million for the reporting period, leaving an outstanding balance of $10.3 billion, which is a 1.8% increase from last year. The courts collected $922 million from non-delinquent accounts and adjusted a total of $465 million. The delinquent revenue collected decreased by 1.5% from the prior year, and the drop is consistent with steady decline in delinquent revenue collections that we've seen in the past few years. The year-to-year decline in delinquent revenue for the past few years is evident in this chart. You can see the last, especially the past 3 years, that we've seen a steady decline. As Andy stated, the decline is attributed to the elimination of the tool that allowed the court to place driver's license holds or suspensions on driver's license for failure to pay. Also to the recent implementation of ability to pay determinations and other court order adjustments. Going forward, we expect the trend to continue. There are more charts and detailed information on this statewide report to the legislature. This is another example of a chart that's included in the report. It's a breakout of the $583 million that was collected from delinquent accounts by entity. So where do we go from here in terms of reporting? As I mentioned before, our Office of Government Affairs is working to consolidate the report. But as of today, please plan on submitting the report to us by next year, in July, and again in September. We'll keep you posted as soon as we know of any changes to that timeline. As far as the performance metrics and the benchmarks, these were developed, as you know, for those of you that work with the CRT, they were developed back in 2008-09, so they are pretty old. And we are aware that we need to re-examine them, particularly now with the changes to the CRT and the reporting requirements, so that they could all align. So we are looking into the benchmarks and the measures. And again, when we start working on them, we will definitely possibly even reach out to a few of you for some feedback or some participation. And lastly, for those of you that are wondering whether any additional changes to the CRT are being considered, we do plan to revisit the CRT as well to figure out if there are better ways to collect the information, such as the information on the payment plans and other areas where the program struggles, see if we could, if there's any way that we can make it a little bit more simple. So on this too, as we move forward, we'll keep you posted. That's all I've got on reporting. I'll hand it over to Andy, who will go over the discharge from accountability and how you all can help us reduce that $10.3 billion of debt.
Exactly. Thanks, Maria. So Maria mentioned the $10.3 billion that's outstanding. Every year, there is a new calculation. That calculation is required to be submitted to the legislature. And since reporting started in about 2003, that number has climbed from about $5 billion to now being $10.3 billion. So what we're going to talk about for the next couple of minutes is what discharge from accountability means and
the first and foremost thing it means is that we're discharging it from accounting, but we are not letting the debtors off the hook. This isn't discharge from liability. It's discharge from accounting. So we'll talk about what discharge from accountability means. I'll go over why we should discharge debt, who can discharge court-ordered debt, what the process is, how court-ordered debt is discharged, and what circumstances make debt no longer worth accounting for. So let's start with a simple definition. An account is a record or statement of financial expenditure or receipts relating to a particular period or purpose. The amount of court-ordered debt a violator owes related to specific violations is an account. So what is discharge from accountability? When we talk about discharge from accountability, we're saying the court-ordered debt is no longer worth accounting for. We're saying it's not worth keeping on the books anymore. What we are not saying is that the violator is no longer liable or responsible for paying the debt, just that we're not going to count it anymore because it's old and the chances are that we can't collect it. Why should we discharge debt? There are a couple of reasons. One is to provide the courts and the counties with an accurate idea of how much court-ordered debt is outstanding. And the second reason is to let the legislature know what accurately may be collectible. When the legislature, through the reports that Maria was just talking about, sees $10 billion in uncollected court-ordered debt, the first thing the legislature thinks is that we are not very good at our jobs. Now, clearly that's not the case. We are very good at our jobs, and our jobs have a lot of moving parts to them. But the bottom line is the legislature sees that number, they see that the number increases every year, and the only conclusion they can come to is that somehow we're not doing something very well. But from our perspective, we think that at least half of that $10 billion in cumulative delinquent debt is not collectible. So in other words, there is debt out there. So violators got tickets. They didn't pay their tickets. It's added up. They have not paid. That debt has equaled $10.3 billion. But the bottom line is the legislature provided us with tools to discharge debt so that we can show a realistic amount of outstanding debt. And that's what we're going to talk about now. Who can discharge debt? So you should look at yourself in the mirror or look at the person sitting next to you and say, yes, it's all about you. Well, at the very least, you can help. You may not have all of the authority, but you definitely can help the process. The collecting entity, which could be the court, it could be the county, it may be a combination of the two, may discharge debt pursuant to the government code. The sections are listed here, 25257 for the counties, and 25259.7 for the courts. So these two government codes authorize and establish eligibility criteria for discharging court-ordered debt by the court or by the county for infractions, misdemeanors, and felonies. So how is court-ordered debt discharged? It's essentially discharged on the authority of the presiding judge if the court is responsible, or the Board of Supervisors, if the county is responsible, or a combination of both. And the mechanism is an application. An application for discharge must be submitted by the collecting entity, so this could be you, to either the court, to the PJ, or to the Board of Supervisors for their approval. So, practically speaking, if this is something that is in your realm of responsibility, you create an application. And that application would include the total amount owing, the names of the persons liable and the amount owed by each, the estimated cost of collection, the likelihood of collecting that debt, and any other relevant information. So in the new report that you were required to submit the data for, which came about very, very early this year in July, you had to, for the first time, report the estimated cost of collections for each type of collection activity. That same information can be used in an application that you create that you would then send to your court executive or to the financial officer for the county, and then it would move up the chain. So an application includes all of the information you see on the screen, any other relevant information that would explain why discharging is a good idea, and then the county or the court can authorize. So if it's the county, they're probably going to put it on their consent agenda and they're going to vote. If it's the court, if it's the presiding judge can just sign the application and the debt will be discharged. Now, as a practical matter, since counties and courts do have to work together often for the discharge, for the collections in general and the distribution of those collections, the statute also requires that within 45 days after discharge, the court and county should report to each other all court-ordered debt that's discharged from accountability. And the report that you're going to send to the other entity is going to include the case number, the case type, whether it's an infraction, misdemeanor, felony, the amount discharged, and the number of years since the debt became delinquent, or if it was a payment plan, when the last payment was made. So what makes debt no longer worth accounting for? So I like to give the scenario where my friend Julie in high school about 40 years ago, she borrowed $5 from me to get lunch one day, and she never paid me back. She still owes me that $5. She's very nice, by the way. There's nothing. Julie is a lovely person. She just happens to owe me $5, and it's 40 years later. So what makes debt no longer worth accounting for? The balance is too small to justify the cost of collections. For me to go after Julie for $5 40 years later would just cost way too much. It's just not worth it. Another reason that debt is not worth accounting any longer is the likelihood that the collection doesn't warrant the expense involved. So not only is the amount too small for me to go after Julie, the cost of collection doesn't warrant me going after her. Now, for the purposes of the collections that you do, you also can look to 1463.007 in the Penal Code for all of the best practices. If you've employed many of those best practices and they have not resulted in you getting the money paid from the violator, that's a good indication that it's not worth accounting for the debt anymore. So there are some other things in the statute that are worth considering. For example, if the debtor is deceased, has no assets, and a copy of the death certificate has been submitted, also a good reason to discharge the debt. If for infractions at least 5 years have gone by, or for misdemeanors and felonies, 10 years have elapsed from the date of debt becoming delinquent, perhaps it's worth discharging. So, in summary, discharge from accountability is an accounting term. It is not releasing the violator from liability. Reporting uncollectible debt gives the wrong impression, particularly to the legislature. And on top of it, the legislature has given us tools, express authority, to discharge debt. Now, I talked about applications and reports earlier in this presentation. If you go to the link that you see on the screen, we have sample reports, sample application documents, we've got FAQs, and a lot of other information about discharge, so please use those resources. If you have any questions, communicate them to us either through the chat feature on this WebEx or after today's call. You can give a call to the Funds and Revenues Unit, and we will be happy to provide you more information. Any questions? Nothing's come in, so at this stage of the game, I'm going to ask Manny to talk to you about the Statewide Collections Master Agreement.
Thank you very much, Andy. Hello, everyone. My name is Manny Mandapat. I'm the fiscal analyst with the Funds and Revenue Unit. I will quickly talk to you about the statewide collections master agreement. The Judicial Council is intending to award 14 statewide master vendor agreements for collection services. 8 are current vendors and 6 are brand new. The listed vendors will help facilitate with the collection of court-ordered debt. The Judicial Council awarded the master agreements for an initial 5-year term with an additional 5-year option for a potential maximum of 10 years. The contract will be effective January 1, 2019 to December 31, 2023. To begin services from a vendor, your court will need a participating agreement. A form is attached to the master agreement for your use. Also, if necessary, the Judicial Council attorneys are available to assist the courts only. The master agreement is in place for the court's convenience. Participation is not mandatory, nor are the courts held to contracting only with the master agreement vendor. As mentioned, for those who want to contract for collection services under the master agreement, you will need to enter a participating agreement, which deals with the specifics. This agreement between the two parties will outline and define the accounts to be transferred, schedule of transfer, as well as any transactions the vendor can provide. In choosing a vendor from the approved list, we ask that you please do not contact the new vendor until the master agreement has been executed, which will be on January 1st. By then, an updated list of approved collection vendors, their contact information, master agreements, and pricing could be found at the first website link provided. This concludes the collections activities section. We will now pause for any questions submitted through WebEx. Mark, do we have anything?
There are no questions at this point.
Okay, thank you. So if there's no questions, we will now take a 5-minute break. We ask to please do not hang up or put us on hold. We will be back online at exactly 2:05 p.m. starting with the Franchise Tax Board. So thank you again, everyone, and see you back in 5 minutes.
Hello, everyone. Hopefully you had a nice break. We are going to get back in action, and we're going to kick it off to the Franchise Tax Board.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Jacobson. I'm one of the supervisors in the Quarter Debt Collections Program, and I would like to thank you for having us here today. Quarter Debt will use this forum to provide training on how to report payments made in your office. And I would like to point out that this information and material that I'm sharing today is not the same material that I've shared in the past. So my objectives today, I'll be covering the following: what is considered to be a payment in an office, how to report payments made in your office, what does Franchise Tax Board quarter debt do with the reported information, and I will also provide contact information if you should have questions after my presentation today. So, what is considered a payment in the office? A payment in the office is any funds remitted directly to your office on a case that has been referred to the Franchise Tax Board quarter debt for collection. Sometimes you may receive a payment in your office when you don't take payments normally. In these cases, we recommend that you refer them to Franchise Tax Board quarter debt to make the payment. How do you report payments made in your office? The easiest, most accurate, and highly recommended way is to utilize SWIFT. This way, you can report the payments to Franchise Tax Board quarter debt in an efficient manner. And as you can see on the slide, this is the actual form and the payment notification form that you use. talk about reporting. It is imperative that you report any and all payments you receive to your our office for the quarter debt to refer to avoid being billed later. If you do not accept payment in your office, and if you are adamant about on giving, they are adamant about giving you the funds, it is still required that you report it to Franchise Tax Board, DOD. Please note that the exception types in the slide are not required to be reported to us, such as payments collected through the Interagency Intercept Collections Program, payments collected through liens filed by the client or an agent for the client prior to referral to Franchise Tax Board, the payment collected after Franchise Tax Board has had returned the case under the guidelines set forth in our MOU, or simply payments that the client can prove that didn't result from our actions. So what does Franchise Tax Board do with the reported payment information? Once we receive your reported payments, we will process the 15%, such as we do when you receive payment in our office, apply the 15% admin fee, and bill you quarterly to satisfy the accumulated fees. So here's our contact information. Please feel free to contact any of the following individuals on this slide. We will use these future presentations to provide you more educational opportunities such as this one. And again, we thank you for having us today, and I'll turn this over now to Alex.
Thank you, Jennifer. My name is Alex Escobar. I am the program manager for the Interagency Intercept Collections Program. And today I'm going to cover some of the Intercept participation basics. So for the objectives, I'll cover a little bit of the background and the program eligibility. I'll go over the annual timeline and how our program works, the notice to debtors, the account modifications, your role and responsibility, the reports that we utilize, along with the forms that we require to participate in the program. We'll cover cost and go over a few statistics and a case highlight. And we'll also go over what's ahead for our program. So FTB administers the Intercept program on behalf of the State Controller's Office. We redirect state tax refunds, lottery winnings, and unclaimed property. And just a quick note, in calendar year 2017, we redirected over 946,000 payments and collected $344 million. So how do we differ from other collection services? Well, a few things that we don't do. We don't make collection calls. We don't set installment agreements. We don't issue wage garnishments or bank levies. We do not file liens, and we do not report to credit agencies, since all of our intercepts are from personal income tax, lottery winnings, and unclaimed property disbursements. Next, we'll cover program eligibility. In order to participate in the Intercept program, you must be a state agency, a county, city, California college, or a special district. And on the screen, you'll see some of the more common types of debts that are referred to our program. Now, I must remind you that the client is responsible for referring debts that meet the criteria set forth in the government code section. And we strongly recommend that you work with your internal legal office to determine if your debt types qualify for the Intercept program. Next, I'll cover the timeline. So you can find the Intercept program at any time. However, since we process most state tax refunds during the first 3 months of the calendar year, your agency will benefit most by following our yearly timeline. So if you look on the screen, in September is the ideal month to submit all of your forms. You must mail the Intercept notice to all debtors during this month. And then in November, you would submit the annual load file to the Franchise Tax Board. By December, we at the Franchise Tax Board urge any current year accounts that you have with us. And by the end of December, we would update all of your new accounts for the following calendar year. And then around April or May, the state controller's offices, state controller's office would send a bill to your agency for all of the offsets that occurred this year. So how the program works. Participating agencies must submit debtor accounts via Secure Web Internet File Transfer, also known as SWIFT. And the delinquent accounts must meet certain criteria. Example, the debt type must qualify under the Intercept Program Authority. Your agency is required to mail a intercept notice to each debtor, allowing them at least 30 days to respond. The debt amount should be and the debtor should not be the debtor should have a valid Social Security number, and if the debtor has more than one debt, all debts should be rolled up into one lump total, so one lump sum. And once we receive your annual file through SWIFT, we upload it to our system, we flag our system with an offset indicator, and if any of those debtors have a tax refund or unclaimed property or lottery winnings, then we will offset any of those winnings to pay debts. So when an offset occurs, we send the debtor a notice of intercepted funds. We have three versions of this notice, one for tax intercepts, one for lottery, and one for unclaimed property. The following information is provided on each notice. It includes the debtor's account number with your agency, your agency's public contact information, the original payment amount they were expecting to receive, the offset amount, the remaining refund or payment amount, and the government code sections authorizing the intercept program. And also new that this past January, we added our phone number to this notice just to provide an additional service channel to all of the debtors. So now it's January, and the accounts you submitted in your annual load are with the Franchise Tax Board. But what about adding new accounts or making changes to those accounts throughout the year? Well, you can add, change, or delete an account at any time during the year. To avoid overcollections, you should modify account balances when payments are made in your office. Always delete the account when a debt is paid or your debtor has filed. And for your role and responsibility, participating agencies are responsible for modifying all balances on accounts, refunding debtors any amount we overcollect, responding timely to customer contacts, paying the annual intercept program service fee, and following the confidentiality guidelines as outlined in the participation guide. Now, on to the reports. So we provide weekly offset reports, and there's three separate reports, one for each type, one for each payment type, and these are generated on a weekly basis, and if there's no offset activity for any given week, we'll not receive our report. Fund disbursements and reversals. So the state controller's office will disburse payments in the middle of the subsequent month. If you cannot reconcile the payment amount with your weekly offset reports, please contact us and we'll be happy to help you resolve your issue. Also, occasionally we may intercept funds in error. For example, if a tax return is posted under a transposed Social Security number, we may offset the wrong individual. If we determine your agency received funds in error, we will reduce your next monthly payment by the reversal amount. We will also send you a reversal notice advising you of the change so you can make the adjustment on your end. So now that I provided all of this background about the INTERCEPT program, I'm going to discuss how to participate in the interagency INTERCEPT program. Because the FTB administers IIC on behalf of the State Controller's Office, you must first obtain approval from the State Controller's Office. The way to do that is to submit the initial request to participate to SCO. This is a one-time process for SCO to approve your agency and the debt type that you wish to submit to the INTERCEPT program. Once your agency is approved by the State Controller, you will work directly with the Franchise Tax Board to participate. It is critical that the program it provides all the requirements, criteria, and record layouts necessary for effective participation in the program.
Maplewood, Minnesota.
There are three participation requirements which must be submitted to the Franchise Tax Board annually. So they're listed here on the screen. The first is the intent to participate. Second is a vendor/contractor confidentiality statement.
What's the Golden Girl's name?
And the third is
okay,
the cost of your pre-intercept notice. So what is the cost? The State Controller's Office bills annually to reimburse the administrative cost of the program. And the fee is based on actual cost incurred.
Alex, can you hold on just a sec? This is Andy. Whoever is chatting, we can hear all about your niece and your plans to go to the Midwest. If you could please just put the phone on mute, that would be super helpful. Thank you so much. All right, Alex, go ahead.
Thank you. So the State Controller charges a fee to reimburse the administrative cost of the program, and the fee is based on actual cost incurred and varies each year. So for 2019, the approximate cost is going to be about $2.25 per offset. And like I mentioned earlier, the State Controller's Office sends the bill for the previous year, usually around April.
Farmer County, St. Olaf, Minnesota.
So what are the benefits of the INTERCEPT program? Well, it provides an additional revenue source for your agency. It's a low-cost collection alternative, and the sources that we collect from rarely qualify for hardships.
Fill out the paperwork.
People don't really.
Whoever gets the most right wins the game.
Tax refund or winning the lottery to pay their monthly bills. Next, I'll go over some stats for the 2017 participation year. As I mentioned in the beginning, we collected over 946,000 payments valued at over $344 million. And you can see the breakdown here on the screen. The majority of that came from personal impact intercepts. And that's why we have provided the timeline for the ideal time to participate in our program. Next, I'll go over a case highlight that we had earlier this year. So we had the Contra Costa Superior Court. They submitted a case with a debt of over $72,000, and it was included in their annual load file in December 2017. Now, the debt originated in 1994 and was for a victim restitution case. In February of 2018, the debtor played the lottery and was due to receive a payment of more than $135,000. So we were able to successfully collect the full $72,495 for the Contra Costa Superior Court. And the debtor still received about $2,000. So it was a win-win. And this goes to show you that even though some of your debts may be older, as in this one originated in 1994, there are a lot of benefits of still submitting some of these older accounts or older debts to the INTERCEPT program. What's ahead? So in 2019, we're planning to pilot to submit accounts without Social Security numbers. We're working with a few agencies who have expressed interest in submitting debts without Social Security numbers, and we're looking to see how this is going to play out for us and how successful we are. So we're still gathering data. We're in the early stages of this, as pilot's actually going to start in 2019. And probably by the end of 2019, we'll have a better understanding of how successful it is and if we can open it up for full implementation. Also, agency codes. If you currently participate in our program, you know we have a two-digit agency code. We're starting to run out of agency codes, so moving forward in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll be increasing that to a five-digit numeric code, and there will definitely be a lot more communication about that as we get closer to implementation. Also, the annual load via SWIFT. So previously, if your agency participated in annual load, you may be familiar with the CD process. So after we have uploaded all of your debts into our system, we put debts and any fallouts on a CD, and we mail them to your agency, and we provide an encryption code so you can access the data on the CD. So starting in 2019, all of this information will be sent back to your agency via SWIFT, and CDs will no longer be mailed. And on this screen here, we have our contact information. Should your staff have any questions, you or your staff have any questions about participating in our program, you can contact our liaison line, that 916-845-5344 phone number. We also have a new toll-free phone number available for debtors to contact. And you can also send us your questions to our email ID listed on the screen. That concludes our presentation for the Intercept program.
We'll just text check. Are there any questions through the chat at this moment in time? Okay, so no questions. So we will move on to Alexandria from the State Controller's Office. Take it away.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today in this webinar. My name is Alexandria Green. I am a policy analyst with the State Controller's Office Local Government Programs and Services Division, and I assist Don Lowry with the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines. This year, I will be covering a variety of updates to the guidelines and related topics. Following me will be Christopher Ryan from our Division of Audit, Manager of Court Revenue, discussing common audit findings. Before we continue, I want to remind you that any questions related to revenue distribution should be sent to our unit mailbox via email at localgovpolicy@sco.ca.gov. I will briefly discuss the changes that took effect this summer due to urgency legislation, ordinary legislative updates, as well as updates appearing in Revision 29 due to inquiries. In addition to TC 31 reports, and remind you about signing up for notifications of updates via listserv that can be found on the SEO's public website. The Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines can be found on our website using the URL shown on the screen. I hope we are lucky enough to be added as one of your favorite web pages to visit. Also, the current and previous versions of the guidelines, we post addendums due to urgency legislation, training materials, FAQs, and other useful resources. Check it out from time to time. We would like our guidelines to be user-friendly and encourage feedback. So please let us know what you think. Bless you. This year, as with most years, the budget trailer bills resulted in changes to the guidelines. We posted an update with those changes on our website this summer, but let me briefly cover the impact. Eight code sections concerning filing fees for court processes has been amended to reflect the extended sunset date of additional fees to June 30th, 2023. Please notice that one code section, Government Code Section 70662, has been extended to January 1st, 2024. Please review these codes when you have the time, as the sun is still rising high. There are three code sections that have been added or amended in the guidelines due to urgency legislation this past summer. Government Code Section 4216.6 addresses a civil penalty on behalf of the Regional Notification Center system if any individual violates the excavation, operation, or subsurface installation process. That distribution of the penalty is in addition to the guidelines. You'll notice Code of Civil Procedure 384 concerning unclaimed class action judgments should be familiar, as it was another amendment last year. So it was amended to remove the distribution to the state fund account this year. Moving forward, 100% of the funds shall be distributed to nonprofit organizations or foundations, child advocacy programs, or nonprofit organizations providing civil legal services to the indigent at the judge's discretion. Health and Safety Code Section 103680, distribution of funds has been amended to reflect the change in fund account. The money will no longer be distributed to the Peace Officers Training Fund and shall now be deposited into the State Penalty Fund. The majority of changes to the guidelines each year occur through ordinary legislation. These bills take effect on January 1st, 2019 or later if the statute requires. This year, not counting the two urgency legislation bills, we had 8 bills passed which impacted the guidelines. As you see on this chart, 8 entries were directly affected and either added or amended from the guidelines. I don't expect you to read all these today, but I will briefly discuss. Please do not close your ears just yet. 5 code sections have been added to the guidelines to include civil penalties imposed for various violations. Please take notice that Code of Civil Procedure Section 1798.155 is not effective until January 1st, 2020. And Health and Safety Code Section 19891 is not effective until July 1st, 2019. It is important that everyone is aware that Penal Code Section 287, which was formerly numbered as Penal Code 288A, discussing the additional fine imposed for the AIDS education program. The renumber of that code section is also referenced in Penal Code Sections 1463.009 and 294A and B. However, there wasn't any content changes to the entries. There are many entries that have been amended this year due to inquiries received by the State Comptroller's Office. We appreciate the inquiries we receive as they allow us to amend the guidelines to reflect current legislation. There's a saying, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, this is our child, and we thank the village. These changes are included in the Revision 29 of the guidelines that has recently been posted in late November. We want to make sure that everyone is aware of these changes due to inquiries that we have received. However, I would strongly recommend that everyone look at the summary of changes, as it will give a thorough breakdown of the amendments made to each code section. There were a few code sections that we were made aware of to reflect the difference in the distribution of funds. Funds are to be distributed to the jurisdiction where the offense occurred and not the arresting agency. Therefore, if a county officer made an arrest, but the violation occurred within city limits, the county officer will receive a hearty thank you, but that's just about it. The penalty imposed shall be distributed to the city where the offense occurred. This holds true and has been amended to reflect in the following code sections. Penal Code Section 1463.11 and Vehicle Code Section 42007.3 concerning red light violations. In addition to Food and Agriculture Section 31663 pertaining to vicious or dangerous dogs. In addition, a number of other entries were impacted to reflect the correct distribution of court revenue pursuant to Government Code Section 68085.1, which concerns civil fees collected on behalf of various code sections that should be deposited into a bank account established by the Judicial Council. Codes include but are not limited to Code of Civil Procedure 1993.2, 631.2, Family Code Sections 304, 3112, 3153, 7851.5, 9001, and Government Code Sections 6103.5D and 68086. Now I'd like to touch on the TC31 forms briefly. We provide a link to the forms on our webpage as well as a link found on the state accounting page. These forms are updated from time to time as new funds are added or codes change. So please check regularly to make sure you have the latest one. We want to also remind you that the form includes the most commonly used codes, but there are lines for adding additional entries. If you need the code numbers for funds not listed or just plain assistance with the TC31, please do not hesitate to contact Marietta Delton or Wendy Kataya using the email found on this slide. Finally, consider this a friendly holiday reminder. If you sign up for our listserv notification service, we send out notices to everyone on our list when we post updates to our website. So consider yourselves a popular crowd of trial court revenue distributors. Oh, yay. Okay. If you want to avoid the thrill of checking our page every few weeks for updates, go to the URL on the page or click on the subscription link at the bottom of our page and sign up today. We have published revision 29 of the guidelines recently. Please visit your favorite webpage, but remember the amendments take effect in January 2019, unless otherwise stated in the summary of changes. We thank you, and I'm now handing it over to Mr. Christopher Ryan.
Hi, thanks, Alexandria. Good afternoon. My name is Chris Ryan. I'm audit manager of the Court Revenue Unit. We perform audits of court revenue distributions, and the reports are posted up on our website. Today I'm going to give you a recap of our year to date. So we've issued two final reports. We have five reports in process and 11 audits are currently in progress. And to kind of give those counties and courts a heads up as to which ones are coming up. In terms of those upcoming audits, we have Santa Clara, San Francisco, Madera, Los Angeles, and San Mateo. To go over some of our common findings, and these, I guess, have been common findings for quite some time. Hopefully, as we go through different cycles, or go through the cycles of all the counties and do follow-up audits, that some of these will start to change, but I guess these have been the similar ones for quite some time. First off, we have calculation errors concerning the 50% excess of qualified revenues calculation. And this is impacted by parking surcharges. Emergency medical air transportation penalties are not consistently distributed for red light violations and traffic violator school fees. Parking surcharges are not consistently remitted, and this has to do largely with external entities such as colleges and universities. And the unremitted parking surcharges, a portion of that goes into the excess of qualified revenue calculation, but also impacts that calculation as well. This past year, we've been working through some process changes relative to parking surcharges. Basically, we're including these external parking entities in the audit process. That includes the cities and counties, cities and colleges and universities. In terms of the process, we're including them in the status meetings, exit conferences, draft and final reports, and we will solicit responses to the draft reports. This has sort of bogged down our process in the past year because we are including these external entities, and we can have as many, from 3 to 9 separate entities that we're dealing with in terms of the audit process, which is really kind of slowing it down. We've also made some changes to the report language, and this is to clarify responsibilities, specifically that the counties aren't responsible for these external entities, to separate parking findings for each of the external entities, and to clarify requirements for interest and penalties. So with that, that's all that I have. And I'll turn it over to Donna.
Thank you. Do we have any questions at this point? Nothing in the chat. Okay, great. So I'm going to wrap things up here. And we'd like to draw attention to this slide. Go ahead and save the dates for the in-person revenue distribution training that will be coming up. We'll be in San Diego on April the 23rd, and we will have two sessions in Sacramento on May 7th and May 8th. We are currently in the planning stages for the breakout sessions. We're reviewing the feedback from last year and would love to have your input. Some of you expressed interest in presenting at the last live training. We want to hear from you. Please send us an email through revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. Also, all of our wonderful presenters provided contact information and resources during their presentations. However, the next two slides provide links to resources as well as contact info, so you don't have to scan through the entire presentation to figure out where you want to send your questions. So, as you can see, State Controller's Office, Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedules, court-related legislation, if you want to read reports, they are on these next two slides for your easy, convenient reference. With that, in closing, I want to thank you all for being here with us today. If we can assist in any way, please feel free to reach out to us. We are here to serve you. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Can I ask a question real fast?
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, we do have to save the date because my printout has a different date than what you just showed, I think.
I'm sorry. Can you try one more time? You're really difficult to hear.
You're save the date for what were the dates? Because it's different than my printout.
Oh, my apologies. Yes, there was a change, a last-minute change. So in San Diego, it is April the 23rd, which is a Tuesday. And then here in Sacramento, 2 days, May 7th and May 8th.
Yeah, that's fair.
Great, yes. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you all.
Thank you.
The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you, and goodbye.